From the Moan Broadcast Center at KPCC, it's The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, Kanye West takes his operatic vision to the Hollywood Bowl. Then the graphic novel Watchmen explored good and evil through a dark satire of superheroes. The HBO series has its eye on another target, one of this country's original sins.
Audiences are used to the idea that the good guy is going to fight against the bad guy and prevail in the end. When the bad guy is the institution of white supremacy, the good guy is not going to, in episode 9 of season 1, spoiler alert, white supremacy is not defeated.
And the Grammy Museum expands a gallery that's dedicated to Latin music. All that coming up on The Frame. Welcome to The Frame. I'm John Horn. On Sunday evening, fans of rapper Kanye West gathered at the Hollywood Bowl to see and hear the artist's latest venture. It's an opera based on the biblical story of a Babylonian king. This comes on the heels of Kanye's most recent album called Jesus is King and a series of Sunday services he's been mounting at various locations. LA Times pop music critic Michael Wood was at the Hollywood Bowl, and he says the cast and crew could have used a little more time to get ready.
This thing was down to the minute. I mean, look, I've been to the Hollywood Bowl a jillion times. I have never seen through the gate in the back sawdust all over the place. They were constructing something that I think when I saw it later come out in the show, it was like some sort of long feasting table. You could hear what was either sound check or just indeed Kanye like finishing writing the opera. Like, they didn't even let people in till however long past doors were supposed to open, and you could hear them working on the opera inside.
So even if the paint was dripping wet, did you get an idea of what it was that he was after? Because it feels like it was not finished, but maybe there was a germ of an idea at the center of it?
Yeah, that's fair to say. Look, you want to be charitable to somebody who's trying his hand at a new form. But I think maybe somebody said opera to Kanye and he said, yeah, that's the ticket. Nothing about this felt like he had anything to say that required opera as the form to say it in. I think that the story, such as it was not really considered. I mean, the whole thing was just sort of grabbing ideas from what we think of as opera and just sort of smushing them all together.
How does this fit into some of the other things that Kanye has been doing recently, including Sunday Service and his Jesus is King album?
So obviously, there's the sort of religious content, which connects to the album, the Jesus is King album, which connects to Sunday Service. The music in this Nebuchadnezzar show was rooted in choral singing, which is also the case with Sunday Service. And also, you know, you can think about this in the larger context of Kanye's dogged attempt to break into, you know, sort of high culture, to sort of do something that he's putatively been told he can't or shouldn't do, which that's kind of thrilling. That's an interesting animating impulse, but not much follow through.
You and the Times classical music critic Mark Swed had this conversation in the paper, and it feels like both of you are trying to figure out if it actually was opera, how you define opera. It seems really hard to categorize what it was that you guys saw.
Mark had some great points, which was that opera is open to all kinds of interpretation. I didn't know that the opera, the word in Latin, just means works. Artistic works. That's cool. That's creatively liberating. But other people have sort of said that, no, this is actually an oratorio because Kanye was just sort of reciting Bible verses as the music and the sort of dancing went on sort of next to him. So I don't know. I mean, I like the idea that it disrupts what we think of as an opera, but I also don't know how purposeful or how sort of willful that disruption even was.
I think it's probably impossible to know what's in the mind of Kanye West. Kanye may not even know, but I want to ask you about this whole recent embracing of religion. He recently did a Sunday service program with a televangelist, Joel Osteen, and there was a quote in the Washington Post from Jonathan Walton, who is the dean of the Wake Forest Divinity School, who said, "Kanye West and Joel Osteen are a match made in market-driven heaven. The communion table has become a merch table." And I'm wondering if you felt the same way, that maybe part of this is as much a commercial play as it is maybe a spiritual reawakening.
For sure. I mean, if you've seen Sunday service, you can't help but be struck by the fact that this is a commercial enterprise, but also the sort of worship of Kanye himself. What you come away with is that the whole thing is built around Kanye being worshipped by the audience. Last night at the Hollywood Bowl, there's a part of the show where dozens, maybe hundreds of robed figures who are part of the show came down the aisles. But then Kanye in the on stage is like, "Everybody in the audience, you know, put your arms up." And so, you know, people do, and these robed figures do as well. It was pretty culty, you know what I mean? I don't want to use that word lightly, but it was pretty culty. But again, like, what is the cult? What is the belief system here? I don't know.
Michael Wood is the pop music critic at the LA Times. Michael, thanks so much for coming back on the show.
Yeah, man. Thank you, John.
Coming up on The Frame, HBO's Watchmen had a pivotal episode last night. The series creator and the episode's director walk us through the story. Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. The graphic novel Watchmen, written by Alan Moore and illustrated by Dave Gibbons, was published more than 30 years ago. Its reworking of superhero myths set in an alternative 1985 had a common effect on a generation of readers.
I've always described reading the first issue of Watchmen as feeling like I was dropped on my head.
That's Damon Lindelof. He harnessed that sensation to co-create Watchmen, which is set in a slightly different present day. Lindelof's series explores the trauma and legacy of white supremacy in this country. In the sixth episode, co-written by Lindelof and Cord Jefferson and directed by Stephen Williams, further complicates the story. I spoke with Lindelof and Williams about last night's pivotal episode, including the maze of characters and plot points.
I've always been really bad at calculus, so I can only speak in terms of story. And the writer's room, it was a dozen people for 10 weeks before we even wrote the pilot. And that period of time was sort of split between the process of figuring out what happened in the intervening 30 years between the original Watchmen, the story of which ends in November of 1985, and for us in September of 2019, what happened.
Stephen, I'm going to ask you about the sixth episode. It has this conceit about memory, which is a great kind of expositional idea that you can have this physical thing happen to your body, and then as a director, you can go back in time. How did you approach the whole idea of what the conceit of the sixth episode was going to be?
To begin at the beginning, the foundation of the visual incarnation of that episode was almost all pre-existing in the script that Damon and Cord wrote. And I connected with it as soon as I heard about it. When Damon first shared the notion of this memory journey that was going to be at the core of this piece, he rendered it to me verbally before he had actually written anything. And it just spoke to me, and I had a series of images already started occurring to me, even as he was talking about the script.
What were some of those first ideas?
It was more of an approach. It was more, what would it feel like to be back in the 1930s and in that world? And after much discussion, we ended up with this conceit that it would be primarily in black and white, but with specific and strategic incursions of color.
Is it starting?
Starting.
But that it was going to feel, it would have its own specific and unique visual grammar, that it would feel fluid and it would feel subjective, and it would, the transitions from one moment to the next and one scene to the next would tumble somewhat seamlessly into each other in the way that the experience of memory is like.
There is a cinematic trick to the way to tell that story, and that is that the camera will focus on a character and then pan over, and then when it pans back, there's a different actor playing that character, and obviously there's, you know, things that are you are doing off camera, but emotionally, it accomplishes something else, and that is that it lets somebody understand the inherited trauma of a family and of a life, and that there is a way that that device, as a storyteller, creates empathy for the people who are living in the present to understand the past.
You just articulated that much better than we ever could, but I would say that everybody cared deeply about making the show, but something different happened in the making of this particular episode. And I say this with the most tremendous respect imaginable for Stephen, but I respectfully disagree with what he says about it all being on the page. I did not approach this episode with any degree of confidence until Stephen basically took it and made it his own. And I clearly understood he gets this somehow, that conveying this emotional idea that you just said, which is that it's subjective, that we're not just doing a traditional flashback that is showing the audience something that happened in the past. We're trying to show you what it feels like to be inside the mind of your ancestor and to suffer the trials and tribulations that they did both physically, psychologically, and emotionally. And that would all happen through performance.
You could obviously come up with other names for this series. Watchmen fits. Intergenerational trauma doesn't quite sound as catchy, but it is an organizing principle.
Tonight at 8 o'clock. Yeah.
It's this idea of being haunted by ghosts and about how that affects the person you become. I want to play a scene where Will Reeves has dinner with June, who will become his wife, right after he's been inducted as a police officer.
What am I thinking?
I've joined the enemy. The police in this city smother our people under their shoes. Lieutenant Battle is a Tom, and now I am a Tom, too. They just hired me for the publicity, and besides all of that,
you worried about me.
They gave you a gun and a stick. That's what I'm worried about. What you gonna do with them? Because you are an angry, angry man, William Reeves.
I want to ask you about that broader idea about intergenerational trauma, because it's easy to describe Watchmen as, you know, good guys, bad guys, race, policing, but that seems to be the design of the building, not what's actually occupying it.
Well, I think that in order to earn the name Watchmen, there has to be some sort of cultural commentary or cultural presentation. And I don't want to say that the show doesn't take any sides. I think it very clearly comes down on the side of racism is bad. White supremacy is bad. But it's also not something that superheroes are going to be able to defeat anytime soon. So when you set the story metric of this is the bad guy, traditionally, audiences are used to the idea that the good guy is going to fight against the bad guy and prevail in the end. When the bad guy is the institution of white supremacy, the good guy is not going to, in episode 9 of season 1, spoiler alert, white supremacy is not defeated. And so all that's left is the emotional journey of the characters. And so the idea of something is broken inside someone, they're going to, in order to heal, they must first acknowledge. And I think that this sort of raises the question behind perhaps your question, which is there's this idea in America of why are we talking about the past? Get over it. Let's move on. That wasn't even us. We weren't even alive then. Let's just move on. This is mostly white people saying this for the obvious reasons. And this other school of thought, which is you have to look at the past. You have to talk about the past, or else to use the cliche, history is doomed to repeat itself. But for true healing to happen, you need to know the past. When you personalize that idea, as opposed to talk about it in grand thematics like I just was, your past is who you came from. It's your parents and their parents and their parents and their parents. And so this idea that you are feeling fear and anxiety and anger and confusion in your life, and that you were born with it, is a very powerful idea that I think most people who are alive can relate to in one form or another.
We're talking with Damon Lindelof and Stephen Williams about Watchmen. There's a line in the very first episode, at the very beginning, in a silent film, there will be no mob justice today.
Trust in the law.
Trust in the law. And that's you know, a very handy maxim, like everything will take care of itself. And I think what we see throughout the series, and especially in the sixth episode, is that the law isn't necessarily going to help, and that you're going to have to fight against the law, and you're going to have to do things to make sure that the system works in ways that the law isn't working.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that's true in the context of Watchmen, but it's true in the world at large. There are societal structures and systems of power in place, and then there are agents that enforce that power structure and that form of societal organization. And they are not necessarily organized around the principle of justice or equality. They're organized around maintaining the structure as it exists. And in our case, that structure is, in fact, the structure of white supremacy, the all-pervasive, long-standing structure of white supremacy. And what we are endeavoring to show, at least in a portion of the series in general, but specifically in this episode, is that, you know, law enforcement is not separate and apart from the social context in which it exists. It's an extension of it. And so justice is not necessarily to be found within the confines of the way in which law enforcement exerts its influence over a community. Maybe needs to be sought somewhere else. But what's super cool about Watchmen, both source material and the series, is that we all have to be careful about being self-appointed arbiters of justice as well, because we are all human and therefore all subject to imperfection.
Stephen, I want to play one more scene from the sixth episode. This is where Will Reeves is walking home and some of his white police colleagues pull up next to him.
How about you come join us for a beer?
I appreciate it, but I got an early shift tomorrow.
Oh, come on. We're buying.
Maybe another time.
Okay, then. Another time.
The other time is very soon. It doesn't end up being good. When you hear that scene and think about the source material, what threads can you get from the graphic novel that inform a scene like that and let you tell the story the way you told it?
That particular scene wasn't, for me at least, emotionally or visually informed by the source material. It was really kind of informed by an awareness of history and a deep sensitivity to the fact that we were shooting in Macon, Georgia, the South, and my own personal experiences with law enforcement through my life. So that was really all about this kind of this subtextual current of dread and fear about an awareness of what was most likely going to transpire and which does in fact transpire, having been in situations that are comparable to that. That's really what kind of imbued the approach to that scene.
That a black police officer is subjected to the same sort of profiling and harassment and violence that somebody driving while black is today.
Exactly. I mean, you know, it's interesting when, you know, like what Damon was saying earlier, you know, people are like, why are you dredging up history? First of all, it's ironic when people say that, it's ironic that it's coming from a country that, you know, created Faulkner, who famously said, you know, history is, you know, not the past is never the past. In fact, it's, you know, past is never done. Mangling the quote, but and it's not even history. It's like, you know, it's still happening. It's the present. It's still, there is a continuity, a direct continuity between the designation of one group of people as being less than that extends centuries back and exists today.
What Faulkner said is the past is never dead. It's not even past.
Yes, perfect. Thank you.
Correct.
We are correct. That to memory.
Yes. Right. We agree.
Damon Lindelof is the co-creator of the series Watchmen on HBO. Stephen Williams is the executive producer and director of episodes 3 and 6. Damon and Stephen, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Up next on The Frame, the Grammy Museum expands its Latin music gallery.
we're all alone.
I'm John Horn, and this is The Frame. According to Billboard magazine, the global popularity and sales of Latin music are at an all-time high. And so it seems fitting that the Grammy Museum at LA Live has a new space dedicated to Latin musicians. The Latin Music Gallery's recent opening was attended by a wide range of music industry figures. The Frame contributor Beto Arcos was there and has this report.
About 200 people showed up at the opening of the Grammy Museum's Latin Music Gallery. There was a lot to celebrate. When the Grammy Museum opened in 2008, Latin music was barely noticeable.
We tried to convince the people of the museum that it was worth it to have a space for Latinos. And they gave us 15 square meters, which accounts for 150 square feet, more or less.
Gabriel Avaroa is president of the Latin Recording Academy, an offshoot of the Grammy organization. Avaroa says when they began pitching the idea of a Latin music space at the museum, they had to focus on two things. First, education.
We are salsa, we are tango, we are samba, we are bossa nova, we are ranchera, norteña. So they said, well, it's very easy for you to say, but we don't know how to do it. So I retained, on behalf of the Latin Recording Academy, experts in every field, and they came and they put their best. So when you go there, you have all those genres there.
Avaroa says for 9 years they kept complaining about the 150 square feet they had been allocated, until one day he asked, what else can we do?
And they said, well, we need contributions. So we said, oh, let's contribute. So we began being much more cooperative with the museum. And they said, guys, why don't we do something nicer for you?
Avaroa says for the past year and a half, the Latin Recording Academy has been helping the Grammy Museum create the Latin Music Gallery. They went from 150 to 6,000 square feet.
So the difference is huge. It's humongous. It is also true that the presence of Latin music in America has grown, is being more noticed. But they also found that most of the attendees to the museum are of Latin descent, are Hispanics who come to the museum. So if the magic work.
Que viva la telefonía en todas sus variantes.
Well, I think that music brings us all together. And now with our renovations, we're able to tell a lot more stories and a lot bigger stories about the impact of Latin music. So it's very important.
Michael Sticca is president of the Grammy Museum.
And this is kind of Museum 2.0, if you will. So we're actually taking a lot of time and energy and a big investment. This is a $2 million investment we've made on the third floor to really start expanding the storytelling of Latin music.
The inaugural exhibit highlights the Latin Grammy Awards from the past 20 years, including more than 30 songs on rotation heard on a sound system in every room. On display, there's an electric guitar from Colombia's Carlos Vives and an accordion that was played by Jorge Hernandez of Los Tigres del Norte.
Al caer la tarde, por el callejón, las calles vacías.
There's also fashion from the Latin Grammys, including a blazer worn by the late pop singer Juan Gabriel and a dress worn by singer Gaby Moreno, designed by her Guatemalan compatriot, Guichem.
And I wore it at the Latin Grammys in 2013 when I won my Best New Artist award. And about a month ago, I received an email asking if I could send it here. But I told him, well, the dress is in Guatemala because I gave it back to him after I used it. So he shipped it, and now it's being on display here. So I'm really excited. I haven't seen it since I wore it.
Chilean singer Francisca Valenzuela describes a couple items on display that caught her attention.
We're in front of Celia Cruz's dress from an award ceremony of the Grammys. And we love Celia Cruz, you know? We're fans of Celia Cruz. She's amazing. We have the drum set from Osomatli, which I'm a big fan. I was just hanging out with those guys here. They're amazing. I'm such a fan. Proud of all the Latin artists here displayed and excited for a diverse Latin scene.
Osomatli's trumpet player and singer, Azdru Sierra.
Any acknowledgement of the second most spoken language in the world and all the artists that comes with it, it's a step in the right direction.
But perhaps the person that best summed up the significance of the Latin Music Gallery is Benny Bravo. He works merchandise for a big name in Latin music, Mexican pop singer Marco Antonio Solís.
As a Mexican living in the United States, I think it's a great deal to be out here with artists that represent us all over the world. And to be here at the first day that the Latin Grammy Museum opens up this entire floor for the Latino community.
Bravo says all these artists have been working for many years representing their culture, music, and traditions. It was time for them to be represented at the museum. For The Frame, I'm Beto Arcos. Lloro por quererte.
And that'll do it for today. Remember, you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. You'll find us at The Frame. I'm John Horn at the Moden Broadcast Center at KPCC. We'll see you back here tomorrow.